Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции! Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы! Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества! Ура!
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried. Last week we talked on Back in the USSR about Iran's retaliation, its counterattack against the apartheid state of Israel after Israel bombed the Iranian embassy in Damascus, Syria, violating a host of international conventions, including the Vienna Convention, which protects diplomats and diplomatic facilities around the world. It really was an act of war, and Iran responded very proportionately, you know, against two military targets within Israel, two air bases, and responded quite effectively under the circumstances, given that advance warning was given and they clearly didn't want to escalate. Well, Israel did respond to that. They launched a very feeble, from all indications, attack within Iran itself using drones, you know, of course, bombed several locations in Iraq and Syria for good measure, and generally went on in this pattern of aggression, which has been displayed around the Middle East. But I mean, it's really was not a terribly effectual strike as Israeli acts of aggression go. And of course, Israel is still bogged down in Gaza. It is still being defeated fundamentally. you know, the axis of resistance continues fighting and continues grinding down the Israeli apartheid system and its army. And there should be optimism that of the general direction of things. But anyways, one of the things that did happen last week, Ben Norton did an excellent breakdown of this, which I'm going to get to in a moment, of the latest veto in the UN Security Council, which came from the United States, where it vetoed Palestine's application for statehood. You know, this is just the latest instance where, whether it's, you know, shooting down ceasefire proposals or what have you, the U.S., pretty much alone in the world, has basically come down on Palestine and frustrated Palestinian self-determination and really signed the death warrants for, you know, thousands of Palestinians. So I'm going to get to that in a moment, but for now, I want to get to a clip of Kay Pritzker of Breakthrough News. He's an amazing journalist. And he basically is going to explain why Israel has really been trying to escalate in the Middle East, create a regional conflict between Israel and Iran, which it hopes to draw the U.S. into, you know, what its motivations are. And he really breaks it down as to why Israeli aggression has been really reaching kind of like such a fever pitch in the last few months and how dangerous that is. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Netanyahu wants a regional war with Iran. Why? When Israel bombed Iran's embassy in Syria 2 weeks ago, killing one of Iran's top generals, they were knowingly setting off a chain of events that was designed to drag Iran into war. Iran retaliated for the embassy bombing on Saturday, and now, as I'm recording this, the Israeli war cabinet is deciding on timing and scale for its attack on Iran. In hindsight, you can see how the embassy attack was obviously going to trigger this chain reaction we're seeing right now, which could very well boil over into an all-out war. Bombing another country's embassy is an act of war, and Israel obviously knows this. They knew Iran would respond, so then the question becomes, why do it? The main reason is that Israel's basically lost the war in Gaza. At the beginning of the war, Israel set out three primary goals for the war: to destroy Hamas, to get its hostages back, and install new leadership in Gaza that would prevent the Palestinian resistance from ever taking power again. After 6 months, Israel has withdrawn the majority of its forces from Gaza, it's achieved none of its goals, it's indefinitely postponed the invasion of Rafah, and has really only succeeded in turning itself into an international pariah. Like virtually every colonial power before it, Israel's military philosophy is that the side with the most firepower is the side that wins. Israel has historically relied on the use of overwhelming artillery and air power to do most of the work, no different than the United States in Afghanistan or Vietnam. They've also added to it the medieval-style siege campaign and starvation. But this strategy almost always fails, because it doesn't acknowledge that war is ultimately a political battle with a large martial component. You can kill a ton of enemy combatants, you can starve people deliberately, but that doesn't mean they'll accept your dictates. In many cases, it actually makes the resistance to you stronger, because the friends and family of the people you've killed just end up taking arms against you. This is why Israel was never going to beat Hamas. The last 6 months have shattered Israel's illusion of invincibility. It's reaffirmed that Israel can be beaten in battle and basically achieved for Israel the exact opposite of what it set out to do. Israel's projection of strength was supposed to deter resistance. Now, that's gone. Not only did Israel's massacre greatly increase the Palestinian people's support for the resistance, it also undermined its strategic alliances. Israel's callous disregard for human life sparked mass outrage in Western capitals, which made it politically impossible for Western leaders to support Israel without being perceived as supporting genocide. All of these factors combined have, for the first time, created a countervailing force on Western support for Israel, which has changed the odds for Palestine tremendously. We made a whole video going through all the ways the protests and changes in public consciousness are having a real impact on politics, so if you haven't seen that video, make sure to go to our page at Breakthrough News and follow us. But anyway, In that video, we talk about how the tide is shifting with the U.S.-Israel relationship in a way we've never seen before. In a recent anonymous interview with The Telegraph given in late March, Israeli intelligence officials admitted that without U.S. support, Israel wouldn't be able to defeat Hamas. The official says, "If you'd asked me this a month ago, I would definitely say yes, we can eliminate Hamas, because at that time, the Americans were backing Israel." The U.S. doesn't support Israel going into Rafah, which they did before, so the cards right now aren't good, meaning Israel has to do something dramatic and drastic to change the momentum and climate. And now we all know what that dramatic and drastic thing was. The other secondary factors why Israel wants this war are domestic. In case you haven't noticed, Israeli society is starting to rip itself apart over the war. In the past few weeks, there have been massive protests in Israel, protesting Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's handling of the war. Now, to be clear, they're not protesting because the war has killed tens of thousands of innocent people. They're protesting because they want the Israeli government to change tactics to get the Israeli hostages released. It's clear that as soon as the war ends, new elections will be called, which Netanyahu would almost certainly lose. Therefore, for Netanyahu, the war can never end. And with Israel's humiliating defeat in Gaza, his only choice is to expand outward. And if you're thinking right now that risking a regional war to save your political career is insane, all I'll say is yes. And that brings us back to the embassy bombing. Iran really is the only adversary big enough to assure direct U.S. involvement. Israel could pick a fight with Hezbollah in Lebanon, and they very well might, but the U.S. won't go to war to save Israel from Hezbollah. Iran, on the other hand, has been in the U.S. crosshairs for decades. There's an entire wing of the imperialist class that's basically dedicated itself to taking down Iran for the last 20 years. Israel knows that if it instigates a war with Iran, the vast majority of Republicans, and probably also Democrats, would cry for war. The U.S. is saying for the time being that they don't want to get involved in a war, but that's much harder to say when missiles are flying. Going to war with Iran would also allow Israel to flip the narrative from Israel being the genocidal superpower decimating Gaza to the tiny European democracy fighting the big, scary Islamic Republic. Israel hopes that people will forget about Gaza if this war with Iran starts, and this strategy is already being pushed by leaders in the Israeli war cabinet to start a bigger war to recover some sympathy in the West. I want everyone watching this to just really take a moment and appreciate how insane this is. The fact that Israel thinks it has the right to drag the entire region into war just to get out of the mess that it created. And this is the country that US politicians are constantly insisting is our greatest ally. I want every American to think long and hard about what we're being told here. Would our greatest ally take billions of our tax dollars to buy weapons, to massacre women and children, and then blackmail the politicians who dissent? Would our greatest ally bomb another country's diplomatic facility to drag our country into fighting a war they couldn't win? Israel is a great ally for the military contractors, or the oil companies, or the imperialist strategists at the State Department. For them, it's an extension of their interests, but not for the vast majority of people. If we had a real democracy where the special relationship could be put to a vote, the relationship with Israel would end immediately. But we don't live in a democracy. The two major political parties aren't accountable to us and are still fundamentally wedded to Israel. The only thing that would change our policy is if the movement for Palestine makes the price for supporting Israel so great that the ruling class can't support Israel without being seen as completely illegitimate. But whether or not that movement comes into being, that is up to us.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU, that was Kapritz Group Breakthrough News talking about the regional situation in the Middle East and why Israeli aggression has really been, you know, hyped up to, dialed up to 11, and why they're trying to escalate with Iran, why they have been, you know, risking this regional war and trying to get the United States to join them in an attack on Iran. You know, basically it was creating a fait accompli, which will force the United States to support them in this regional conflict that could lead to World War III. You know, it's dangerous, it's reckless, but he explains, of course, why it's going on. So, like I said before, I was going to get to a clip from Ben Norton of Geopolitical Economy Report talking about the latest American veto of a Palestinian proposal in the UN Security Council. And this latest instance really kind of cuts the heart of Palestinian self-determination, because it was a veto of a Palestinian attempt to gain recognition as a state at the UN. That was vetoed by the US last week. And Ben is going to do a pretty great breakdown of what happened there and just of the general injustice of this veto, which of course is only the latest in a long line of the U.S. using its veto power to basically frustrate Palestinian attempts at justice, at self-determination, you know, at resisting Israel's continued apartheid and oppression. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR. I'm just going to play that clip right now.
The United States is single-handedly standing in the way to prevent the creation of a Palestinian state. On the 18th of April, there was a vote in the United Nations Security Council that called for Palestine to be admitted as a UN member state. And there was one country on the 15-member Security Council that voted against the resolution, the United States. And the U.S. has veto power, meaning that Washington was able to prevent the Security Council from recommending that Palestine becomes a member state. And this means that the UN General Assembly, which has 193 member states, is not able to have a vote. So the vast majority of the world, which recognizes Palestine as a state, does not have a voice. They have been silenced because the United States is holding the entire world hostage, blocking the UN from recognizing Palestine. This is the fifth time since October that the US has used its veto power in order to sabotage a resolution in the Security Council that was related to Gaza. In the other four cases, the US blocked proposals of ceasefires and peace that tried to save Palestinian lives, while Israel is using large numbers of US weapons to kill Palestinian civilians trapped in the besieged Gaza Strip. And while this is happening, with staunch US support, Israel is expanding its war on Gaza into a regional war, and Israel is repeatedly attacking Iran. This was confirmed by US government officials who spoke with CNN, and they revealed that Israel actually gave advanced notification to the United States on Thursday, the 18th of April, when it was making its plans to attack Iran. The US knew that Israel was going to attack Iran, and on the same day, the US at the UN Security Council vetoed a resolution that called to recognize Palestine. Now, the Joe Biden administration claims that it supposedly does not want this war to continue to expand, and it supposedly told Israel it does not support its attack on Iran. But this is complete propaganda. Just because the US government says something doesn't mean it actually means it, because in reality, you have to look at what the US government does and not simply what it says. And if you look at the actions of the Biden administration, it has continued supporting Israel 100%, giving it weapons as it continues to expand this war. After all, it was Israel that started this new phase of the war back on the 1st of April when Israel attacked Iran's embassy in Syria, killing top military officials. This was an act of war against Iran. In response to that, the US government ordered Iran not to respond in self-defense, lecturing Iran. Then on the 3rd of April, the US blocked a proposal in the Security Council that would have condemned the attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria. So the US was protecting Israel once again at the Security Council. And then the US showed its blatant double standards, and it demanded hypocritically that the Security Council condemn Iran for attacking Israel in self-defense after Israel attacked Iran first, and after the US prevented the Security Council from condemning Israel for carrying out this act of war against Iran. And then the cherry on top of the hypocrisy is the Biden administration imposed more sanctions on Iran after Iran, which had a right under international law to act in self-defense, carried out a counterattack against Israel in response to Israel's first attack on its embassy. The US did not condemn that. The US told the world to condemn Iran, and then the US put sanctions on Iran for defending itself. So at every single stage here, we can see how the U.S. is blocking peace in the Security Council, is arming Israel as it's bombing women and children trapped in Gaza, and then the U.S. is supporting Israel 100% as it bombs Iran and expands this into a regional war. The U.S. is dragging the world into World War III, and then they're blaming Iran. And meanwhile, in the middle of all of this, the U.S. is openly preventing the recognition of Palestine as a member of the United Nations. And I'm reading here from the UN News Agency. They published a newswire on the 18th of April that is titled, U.S. Vetoes Palestine's Request for Full UN Membership. And this article notes that of the 15 countries on the UN Security Council, 12 countries voted in support of this resolution, including China and Russia, and France also voted in support of it. One country vetoed it, the US, and two countries abstained. Those were the UK and Switzerland. And of course, Britain goes along with the US and basically does whatever it wants. And in fact, let's not forget, it was in fact the British Empire that colonized Palestine, and it was the British Empire that gave its blessing to the creation of Israel as a colonial project back in 1917 with the Balfour Declaration, in which the British Empire said that it would support the creation of this colonial entity through the colonization of the indigenous Palestinian population. And then, of course, later, the U.S. Empire absorbed much of the British Empire after World War II, and the U.S. Empire has continued this colonial project started by the British Empire. And fast forward to today, and we see how the Anglo-American colonial axis continues to oppress the Palestinian people and deny them their inalienable rights to having political representation and a state of their own, which are written into international law. Now, this article at the UN News website pointed out that the resolution that the US vetoed was one of the shortest Security Council resolutions in the history of the body, going back to 1945. All it said was, the Security Council, having examined the application of the State of Palestine for admission to the United Nations, recommends to the General Assembly that the State of Palestine be admitted to membership in the United Nations. That's it. Very simple. And in order for a country to be recognized as a member state of the UN, the Security Council has to approve it in order to later go to the General Assembly for a vote where the world can vote, the 193 member states in the world. But of course, the US has veto power at the Security Council because the US helped to create the United Nations, and the US basically refuses to be part of any international political body unless it has veto power. This is the so-called rules-based international order in which the US makes the rules and orders everyone else around. Now, this UN News report pointed out that back in 2011, Palestine officially requested to become a UN member state, and in 2012, Palestine was voted to be a permanent observer of the UN, meaning that the UN officially recognizes it, but it's not officially a member state, which means that Palestine cannot vote on UN General Assembly resolutions. And it should not surprise you to learn that back in 2012, when the General Assembly voted on this resolution that recognized Palestine as a non-member observer state, 138 out of the 193 member states, the vast majority of the world, voted in support of Palestine, and only 9 countries voted against recognizing Palestine as a non-member observer state. And can you guess what those countries were? The United States, Canada, the Czech Republic, Panama, Israel itself, and the tiny island nations of Micronesia, Marshall Islands, Nauru, and Palau. So it was North America and a bunch of US client regimes that voted against the vast majority of the world in opposing recognizing Palestine as simply an observer state, not even a member.
In fact, 140 out of the 193 member states, roughly three quarters of the world's countries, officially have diplomatic relations with the state of Palestine. They recognize Palestine as a state, but the United Nations does not. And why? Because of the United States. If you look at a map of the countries that recognize Palestine as a state, I mean, it says everything. It's the global South and Russia, the global majority that recognize Palestine, and it's the Western colonial powers, the US, Canada, Western Europe, Australia, and also Japan and South Korea. They are the colonial powers that refuse to recognize Palestine, and it's specifically Washington that is holding the entire world hostage and preventing the Palestinian people from ever having their political rights realized on the international stage. This is modern day colonialism. It is continued by the same colonial powers that colonized the vast majority of the world, and they still treat the world as their colonial property, and they preach their beloved so-called rules-based international order, again, in which the West makes the rules and orders everyone else around. And this shows how ridiculous it is whenever the US government claims that it supports a so-called two-state solution. Every single US president for decades, Republican or Democrat, has always repeated this fake doctrine, this mantra that they've never actually believed in. Joe Biden has said dozens of times that we support a so-called two-state solution whenever he meets with Israeli officials. Back in November, Biden claimed a two-state solution is the only way to guarantee the long-term security of both the Israeli and the Palestinian people. In October, he talked about his trip to Israel and he said, we cannot give up on a two-state solution. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has also claimed dozens of times that supposedly the U.S. supports a so-called two-state solution. He's constantly meeting with top Israeli officials and repeating this doctrine. But when it actually comes to voting at the UN, the US always opposes calls for the creation of a Palestinian state. This is exactly why I said earlier, it doesn't matter what the US government says. It doesn't matter if the Biden administration says that it's angry at Netanyahu and says it supposedly criticized Netanyahu in a phone call one time. It doesn't matter what it says. It matters what the US government does. And we have seen again and again and again and again and again over decades under both Republican and Democratic presidents, the US government has always opposed the creation of a Palestinian state and always supported the most extreme far-right maximalist demands in Israel for full colonization of historic Palestine. The renowned historian Rashid Khalidi at Columbia University has shown in his book, Brokers of Deceit, how the U.S. has undermined peace in the Middle East, how Washington always opposed the creation of a Palestinian state, and Washington has always prevented peace in Israel-Palestine. He begins the book referring to U.S. officials as dishonest brokers, and Rashid Khalidi wrote that an American-brokered political process has for more than 35 years reinforced the subjugation of the Palestinian people, provided Israel and the United States with a variety of advantages, and made considerably more unlikely the prospects of a just and lasting settlement of the conflict between Israel and the Arabs. Now, this book was published in 2014, so it's a decade old, but everything that he wrote about is even more true today. Professor Khalidi wrote that, quote, the policy of the United States toward the Palestine question has actually functioned to exacerbate rather than resolve this problem. He detailed how central the support of the United States was for the enduring system of control of the millions of Palestinians living under military occupation, a system that was conceived, constructed, and maintained by Israel. That's a quote. And he added that, quote, the incessantly repeated American mantra, whether in official statements or writing, that is policy-oriented, academic, or journalistic, about a so-called peace process has served to disguise an ugly reality. Whatever process the United States was championing, it was not, in fact, actually directed at achieving a just and lasting peace between Palestinians, and Israelis. Instead of trying to achieve these goals, Khalidi wrote, the process actually undertaken by the United States was aimed primarily at pressuring the weaker Palestinians into conforming to the desiderata of their much stronger oppressor, Israel. The U.S. government does not support peace in Palestine. The U.S. government does not oppose Israel's war in Gaza and its attempt to start a war on Iran. The U.S. does not want Palestinians to have a state recognized under international law. It doesn't matter what Joe Biden says, what Antony Blinken, what Donald Trump says, George Bush. This has been a consistent policy going back decades. This is the reality of the U.S. empire. The U.S. is not a normal country. It is an empire, and it talks about itself as the world policeman, but in reality, it's not a policeman. It is a global dictator. The U.S. sees itself as the dictator of the world. That's why the U.S. is constantly trying to impose its own laws on other countries. It's why it's trying to imprison Julian Assange, an Australian journalist who has never lived in the U.S. It is trying to imprison him in the U.S. for supposedly violating U.S. laws, for doing the so-called crime of journalism. It's why the U.S. sanctions other countries for violating its illegal unilateral sanctions that it imposes on the rest of the world. And we can see this so clearly at the United Nations, where the U.S. is constantly opposing the will of the entire world, excluding the 13% of the population in the West. Now, the United Nations has a very interesting website where you can see all of the times that members of the Security Council have used their veto throughout history. And you can see that dozens of times the U.S. has used veto power in order to block resolutions in the Security Council that had to do with Israel, Palestine. If the consequences weren't so deadly, it would almost be funny. I mean, just looking at how ridiculous it is, at how many times the U.S. has used its veto power in order to protect Israel at the Security Council, because Israel, again, is an extension of the U.S. empire. That's why the U.S. continues to prevent the creation of a Palestinian state, or at least the recognition of a Palestinian state, and always shield Israel. However, there's another very important thing that you should draw from this if you analyze these U.S. vetoes, and you can see that only some of them involve Israel, but the U.S. has also frequently used its veto on the Security Council in order to protect white supremacist colonialist settler regimes in Africa. In fact, as the New York Times reported back in 1970, the first time the U.S. ever used its veto in the Security Council was in order to protect the white supremacist settler colonial regime in Rhodesia, that was named after the British colonialist Cecil Rhodes, a diamond magnate. And he, by the way, had also been in correspondence with the colonialist Theodor Herzl, who wanted to create the State of Israel as a settler colonial project and was seeking the support of the British Empire in order to create Israel. Well, going back to Rhodesia, the U.S. joined the British Empire in supporting these white supremacist apartheid regimes in Southern Africa. And if you look at the list of U.S. vetoes in the Security Council in the 1970s going into the 80s, you can see that many of them involve the U.S. vetoing resolutions that condemned the white supremacist colonialist regimes in South Africa, in what is modern day Namibia, which was being occupied by the South African apartheid regime, and also in Rhodesia. So, I mean, this is the perfect historical symbol of what the U.S. empire represents. For decades, the U.S. was protecting white supremacist settler colonialist regimes in Southern Africa. And meanwhile, the U.S. was also protecting the white supremacist settler colonialist apartheid regime in Israel, in historic Palestine, which carries out the exact same practices of apartheid that were carried out in South Africa. Israel carries those out today against the indigenous Palestinian population. This is why leaders of the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, like Desmond Tutu, constantly compared Israel's apartheid to South Africa's apartheid. That's why they constantly supported Palestinians, because they could see that they were going through very similar colonialist processes of oppression by some of the same colonial powers. Let's not forget that the British Empire also was involved in the colonization of South Africa after the Dutch Empire. And it's why the first ever leader of South Africa after ending apartheid, Nelson Mandela, famously said that without the liberation of the Palestinian people, we are not free. It's why still today, the South African government continues to support the Palestinian people. It's why the South African government took Israel to The Hague, the International Court of Justice, and charged it with the G crime, which I'm not going to say because of the possibility of this video being demonetized. But it's why South Africa has been taking action against the Israeli apartheid regime, because there is so much in common between what they suffered and what the Palestinian people are suffering today. And the common thread is also the U.S. Empire's staunch, unflinching support for Israeli apartheid and South African apartheid. In fact, the CIA helped the South African apartheid regime imprison Nelson Mandela in 1962. He was imprisoned for 27 years for the so-called crime of opposing apartheid and colonialism. He was tortured with U.S. support. And today we see the exact same thing. This is not new. This is what the US empire has always been. This is the real face of US imperialism. US politicians talk about human rights and democracy and rule of law and all this nonsense. They do not actually believe in it. It is all diplomatic cover. It is all a fig leaf for the neo-colonialist policies that they carry out around the world in order to protect the wealth of a small handful of capitalist oligarchs to exploit the majority of the world in the global south. This is what the US empire is actually dedicated to preserving the wealth of this small handful of capitalist oligarchs. But anyway, getting back to the main issue of Palestine, which of course is central in all of these issues of imperialism, we should go back and look at this US veto in the Security Council against recognizing Palestine as a member state. And if we go back to this UN newswire, there are some very revealing comments that were made by the Russian and Chinese delegations. In his statements, China's ambassador to the UN said the decades-long dream of the Palestinian people has been quashed at a time when the admission of Palestine as a full member of the UN is more urgent than ever before. He said the establishment of an independent state is an inalienable right that cannot be questioned. China has been very outspoken in support of Palestine. In fact, China's foreign minister Wang Yi was in Indonesia on the 18th of April, right before this vote happened in the Security Council. And Indonesia's foreign minister had a press conference with Wang Yi, and both of them called on the world to recognize Palestine. They called on the Security Council to allow the UN to admit Palestine as a member state. They also called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. And Wang Yi, the Chinese foreign minister, made some very heated comments here criticizing the hypocrisy of the United States. He condemned the U.S. for claiming that UN Security Council resolutions are non-binding. He said the world was shocked by this claim. He said this shows that to the U.S., international law is only a tool that they use as they want. He said, I believe American government officials should learn basic knowledge, criticizing the ignorance and hypocrisy of the U.S. And he also added that the U.S. government should put aside its ego. And of course, Indonesia has historically been a strong supporter of the Palestinian cause, and its government made very similar comments. But also, if we go back to the UN News report, we can see that at the Security Council session, Russia was quite outspoken in support of Palestine as well. Russia's ambassador to the UN said that the US once again demonstrated what they really think of the Palestinians. For Washington, the Palestinians do not deserve to have their own state. They are only a barrier on the path toward realizing the interests of Israel. He said the absolute majority of the global community supports Palestine's application to become a full member of the UN. And the Russian ambassador said, today's use of the veto by the US delegation is a hopeless attempt to stop the inevitable course of history. The results of the vote, where Washington was practically in complete isolation, speak for themselves. And the representative from Russia pointed out, this was the fifth time the US has vetoed a Security Council resolution since the current war in Gaza. In February, the U.S. vetoed a resolution that was introduced by Algeria that called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. In December, the U.S. vetoed a resolution that was introduced by the United Arab Emirates that also called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. On the 18th of October, the U.S. vetoed another resolution that had been introduced by Brazil, and this was actually a weaker resolution. All it called for was humanitarian pauses to deliver life-saving aid to millions in Gaza. The U.S. vetoed that as well. And 2 days before that, on the 16th of October, the U.S. voted against a resolution that was introduced by Russia that called for a humanitarian ceasefire. And in that case, France and Japan and the U.K., the other colonial powers, joined the U.S. in voting against this resolution calling for peace in Gaza. And after doing all of that, this March, the U.S. pulled another ridiculous political stunt in which the U.S. abstained in a Security Council resolution that called for a ceasefire in Gaza, but only during the month of Ramadan. So not a permanent ceasefire, only during the month of Ramadan. And after this resolution was passed in the Security Council, then the U.S. representative, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, she claimed that the Security Council resolution was, quote, non-binding, which is false. According to Article 25 of the UN Charter, all members of the United Nations have to carry out the decisions of the Security Council. Its resolutions are indeed binding under international law. So the U.S. was trying to rewrite international law in order to protect Israel as it was bombing Gaza, and simply in order to prevent the implementation of a resolution that only called for a temporary ceasefire during the month of Ramadan, which Israel ignored anyway, and the U.S. continued to give Israel weapons while it ignored the Security Council resolution. And of course, the U.S. has also been staunchly supporting Israel and sending him more weapons, as Israel blatantly violates a ruling by the International Court of Justice at The Hague, the top legal authority of the U.N., the top legal authority in the world. And the court said very clearly that Israel could be investigated for violating the Convention on the G crime, the worst crime that a country could commit. I'm not going to say that word so this is not demonetized here, because there's been a lot of censorship or people talking about that. Israel is violating that ICJ ruling while UN experts are publicly saying that Israel is committing the G crime in Gaza. Israel is carrying out crimes against humanity. The U.S. government is arming it and strongly supporting it. The Biden administration claims that he doesn't want more war while he continues to give Netanyahu weapons to carry out that war. And now Israel's expanding that war, waging war in Iran as well. And the U.S. is preventing the United Nations from recognizing Palestine as a member state. Quite literally, the U.S. is the world's biggest obstacle to world peace. That is not an exaggeration. The United States government, the U.S. empire, is the biggest obstacle to world peace, period. If you've learned anything since this horrific war started in October, that should be one of the most important lessons that you take away. On that note, I'm going to conclude here. I'm Ben Norton, the editor-in-chief of Geopolitical Economy Report. Please like and subscribe, help to promote our work. And I will be back soon reporting more on the latest geopolitical and economic developments in the world today. Thanks for joining me. See you next time.
You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. I am Siegfried, and that was Ben Norton talking about the latest veto that in the UN Security Council of a proposal for Palestine to have a state and to have recognition from the UN. The U.S. basically shot that down last week. But as grave as that injustice is, I mean, I want to go back to the point that I made at the beginning of the show, which is the general thrust of things is definitely forward. You know, we're seeing Israel's legitimacy just tank, you know, in the last several months. Like, its legitimacy on the international stage is just shot, given its genocidal actions and its just repeated violation of international law and just the trampling on the fundamental rights of the Palestinian people and people around the region. You know, not, you know, like, Israel's been bombing Lebanon, bombing Syria, bombing Iraq. They've just attacked Iran. You know, all this stuff has just been destroying their reputation around the world, including inside, you know, the United States, Canada, the West, the collective West. And, you know, this last clip I want to play, and I really think, you know, there's grounds for hope, you know, in the way things are going, is just, you know, how much things have changed even inside the United States itself with regard to like the delegitimization of the apartheid state of Israel in the eyes of the American public. And I know, like, it's pretty much the same in Canada, you know, like there's just poll after poll after poll. It's just saying, like, you know, people do not support this genocidal onslaught that the Israeli apartheid regime is waging in the Middle East, in Gaza, and in the West Bank increasingly. You know, they don't support it. They increasingly see the monster for what it is. And increasingly they're taking action. They're going out on the streets. They're pushing back. They're fighting back in various ways. You know, they're opposing their own governments that are trying to support Israel. And, you know, in their places of work, on college campuses, you name it, like they're taking action. And like, so you see like this major political shift going on. And that's this last clip I'm going to play in the show. Once again, it's Kay Pritzker of Breakthrough News talking about just how profound this is, and we should be taking hope from it. This transformation going on, this political transformation going on. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Are things actually changing for Palestine? I think a lot of people have been marching for the last 6 months or posting about the genocide every day and asking themselves if any of this is making a difference. And the answer is yes, absolutely. The death toll is obviously still climbing, and the protesters haven't achieved their main demands yet, but if you look objectively at what's actually happened these last 6 months, it's clear that the political crisis in Washington has left the U.S. relationship with Israel in the most fragile place it's ever been. Things that we once thought were impossible are now actually happening, and this is all tremendously favorable for the struggle of the Palestinian people. The first big shift is in public opinion. Historically, Americans have supported Israel by a huge margin. An analysis of 260 Gallup polls dating back to 1967 found that for the last many decades, Americans supported Israel by a margin of around 4-1, but the last 6 months have turned this trend on its head. A poll taken in March of 2024 found that the majority of Americans now disapprove Israel's actions in Gaza, a virtual reversal from where those numbers stood in November of 2023. This includes 75% of Democrats and 60% of Independents. Another poll taken in late March found that the majority of Americans are now again sending more military aid to Israel. This is especially significant because without U.S. military aid, Israel would run out of ammo within a matter of weeks, and its military operations would come to a halt. Polls show that people in the UK, another major arms supplier for Israel, now also want to end weapons sales to Israel. This shift is also largely coming from young people. While Israel's favorability has fallen across all age groups, among young people, it's fallen 26%. And it's the Zionists who are afraid of this more than anyone. Audio from Elite Anti-Defamation League Call, which is a Zionist organization that seeks to equate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, their CEO, Jonathan Greenblatt, was caught freaking out about how many young people were waking up to Israel's true nature.
We have a major generational problem.
This is also why the Israel lobby is now invested in the attempt to ban TikTok.
TikTok, if yes. You will, it is the 24/7 news channel of so many of our young people, and it's like Al Jazeera on steroids.
Another huge development is the return of a mass movement for Palestine. We've seen record-setting marches in the last 6 months, including the March of 500,000 people in Washington, D.C., the largest protest march in Canadian history. The U.K. also had a few marches with over 1 million people, which is crazy when you consider this is 1.5% of the population. There were also massive marches in Iraq, Yemen, Indonesia, Pakistan, Cuba, France, Turkey. What the last 6 months have made clear is that the vast majority of people living on this planet right now support Palestine. But what's arguably more significant than the size of the protests is their targeted and sustained nature. I can't remember any movement in recent memory that's been so effective at denying politicians the ability to speak uninterrupted. Protesters have been disrupting genocide-supporting politicians so consistently that even the biggest media outlets in the country can't ignore it anymore. It's gotten so bad that the Biden campaign has basically said it can't set foot on a college campus, and they even have to resort to doing background checks on the people buying tickets to private fundraising events to prevent these disruptions. These protests have also inspired organizing and vocal dissent within Biden's own staff, Congress, and executive departments, which has been called, by all accounts, unprecedented. Right now, Joe Biden actually has the lowest approval rating of any president since World War II. There's a very real chance that Palestine could be the decisive issue of a U.S. presidential election, which, who would have ever thought that? And now, nearly 600,000 people have voted uncommitted or cast some other kind of protest vote instead of voting for Biden in the Democratic primaries, which is about 10% of the total vote. Of the five states that Biden flipped in 2020, two of these states, Michigan and Wisconsin, have seen the number of uncommitted votes close to or way beyond the difference that Biden won these states by in 2020. Following the Wisconsin primary, wealthy Democratic donors wrote a memo urging the Democratic establishment to take this movement seriously. It said, quote, "We can tell you that the energy behind uncommitted isn't something that should be ignored, taken lightly, or dismissed. All these indicators of U.S. isolation at home and abroad have had a clear impact on how the struggle is playing out. On October 7th, Biden said his support for Israel was, quote, rock solid and unwavering. Even in early March, Biden said in an interview that there was no red line for U.S. support for Israel. Not even a month later, Biden told Netanyahu that the U.S. would have to reconsider its support for Israel if Israel didn't change course. 2 days later, Nancy Pelosi, a total backer of Israeli apartheid, joined 55 other members of Congress with a letter to end future weapons sales to Israel if Israel continued to kill civilians. Benjamin Netanyahu said himself that what's happening right now is his worst fear. He said in a private meeting that his greatest fear was that the mass protests in Western capitals would create so much political pressure that it would disrupt weapon shipments from the U.S. The Biden administration also abstained from vetoing the ceasefire resolution presented to the UN Security Council, which enraged Israel so much that they canceled a diplomatic trip to the United States. For as long as the U.S.-Israel relationship has existed, U.S. military and diplomatic support for Israel was basically considered a given. To quote Nancy Pelosi,
"If this capital crumbled to the ground, the one thing that would remain is our commitment to our aid. I don't even call it aid, our cooperation with Israel."
But in just the last 6 months, half a century of this special relationship is coming into question. Now, I know a bunch of you are probably already leaving comments about how the U.S. government doesn't actually care about Palestinians and this is all just political theater, not a real change of heart. And we agree. And that's kind of the point. Biden and the U.S. definitely don't want to do this. If it was up to them, they would support Israel forever as a permanent U.S. fortress in the region. But the movement for Palestine has put everything, whether it's Biden's re-election or the legitimacy of the empire, into question. And that's really what the point of protest is. Protests aren't meant to convince the ruling classes to wake up to their moral senses. Protests are meant to create such a deep political crisis for the ruling class that they have no choice but to change their policy. It was exactly this kind of political pressure that made the U.S. genocidal occupation of Vietnam politically untenable. That's also why these politicians will say things that sound good to trick people into thinking they're going to stop supporting Israel without actually changing their policy. They'll do whatever they can to get the protests to stop without having to fundamentally change their policy. Now, it goes without saying that more needs to be done because the U.S. is still supporting the genocide. But at the same time, we should remember that Israel is the U.S.'s most important strategic ally. It was never going to end its relationship with Israel without a massive fight. The U.S. and Israel would love nothing more than for the world to fall into this idea that nothing is changing, that protests don't work, and that the U.S. will never stop supporting Israel. They'd love it because they know that right now, their imperial project is the weakest it's ever been. But whether or not the pressure continues and creates a deep enough crisis for imperialism is up to us. On October 6th, the outlook for Palestine looked bleak. The U.S. had been spearheading a diplomatic deal with major Arab countries where they would normalize relations with Israel one by one. This deal, called the Abraham Accords, overturned a decades-long policy of Arab countries refusing to recognize Israel in solidarity with Palestine. Morocco, the UAE, Bahrain, and Sudan betrayed Palestine one by one, recognizing Israel and establishing diplomatic relations with it. Saudi Arabia was also planning to join the agreement in September, which would have fully normalized Israel's presence in the region and constituted a major blow to the Palestinian cause. On top of this, Gaza had already been facing a slow motion genocide for years. In 2018, the UN issued a report saying Gaza would be unlivable by 2020. Since 2006, Israel had been enforcing a total blockade of Gaza, completely preventing it from building or repairing infrastructure. Even before October 7th, 97% of Gaza's water was undrinkable, people in Gaza received about 4 hours of electricity a day, and Gaza was on the brink of famine, and no one was doing anything. The October 7th counteroffensive completely obliterated the normalizing Abraham Accords and made Palestine the central issue facing the world today. A recent poll taken in Palestine showed that despite the endless atrocities that the Palestinian people have faced, 64% of Palestinians still believe that they'll emerge from this genocidal onslaught victorious. Part of their calculation is that the people of the world will continue to stand with them. So remember that the next time you're having any doubts.
When the general